News, sports, AccuWeather, and more. Wake up with the information you need on WKOK Sunrise on News Radio 1070 WKOK and WKOK.com.
Thank you so much for joining us on WKOK Sunrise. Rob Center, the more fabulous he is, the more amazed we are at just how fabulous he really is. Superlative in every way. On the news line with us now, Samantha Pearson, Executive Director, Lewisburg Neighborhoods, Elm Street Manager, Walk It, Bike It Coordinator, and one of the stars of Radio Free Lewisburg, a highly professional sounding and very professional content podcast that gets updated every couple weeks or so in Lewisburg with very, very timely information for every community around here, Radio Free Lewisburg. Thank you for calling in, Samantha. Thanks for calling in.
Good to be here, Mark.
I do appreciate it. Are you humbled by the intro? You're never speechless.
I appreciate you're our top fan, Mark, for the podcast, I think, actually.
Oh, well, good. All right.
Which is very, very, is great. Something to live up to.
I give you 100 likes every time it pops up. So, okay, well, let's talk about COVID-19. You've been so kind to make sure that you're using some of the hats that you wear to give us good information, public health information, and really just passing along some sort of sound advice, maybe, and or best practices, whatever it happens to be. The testing and timing of when an individual exposed to or thinks they might have COVID-19 or has symptoms, talk a little bit about that today.
Sure, Mark. So this is something that more people in Union County are coming across and having to sort of think through in more detail. And I was really pleased that, with Bucknell coming back, that meant also there's a lot of testing happening on Bucknell's campus, and there have been some professors who have really delved into this. And so Ken Field, who's a biology professor at Bucknell, in order to help people on campus understand he initially, I think, was speaking to his students, but also students in general and faculty and administration as well have benefited from some little reports he's put together. And what he's looked at is, now that people in that community in particular really have been getting tested much more comprehensively, there is a tendency for people to be like, oh, I got tested, I'm good. And what really needed to be and needs to be explained or thought through is that actually getting tested and getting a negative test is not as definitive as you might think, in particular, depending on your own activity or behavior. So the issue is the timing of the testing. You might have, so for Bucknell in particular, they're asking people to do what's called sort of surveillance testing. They're testing everyone on regular intervals, especially like all students. And so the students might actually had to have two negative tests before they returned to campus, supposedly. And they're like, well, I had a negative test. Now I'm good. I can do whatever I want. Well, for one thing, a negative test would only actually tell you, of exposure during a certain time frame. And that's because it takes time for the infection, if you are going to get it, to incubate, to sort of hang out in your system and get going. So you could have, with pretty much all of the tests, tested negative and yet still be in the process of coming down with it. So there's that aspect, which is that you could have tested too early, in a sense, and not know yet that you are actually going to be coming down with it. Plus, there's obviously also, unless you were in total isolation, you could have tested positive or tested negative and then proceeded to get infected. So unless you are, quote, living in a bubble, which, some people are doing, but as we've, I think, all learned, is much harder than you might think, one test only gives you retroactive information. It looks back in your history to basically at least 2 days before the test says you didn't have it yet. So that's a timing thing that's confusing. It could mean that if you get exposed to someone, you might actually, or you're in a risky situation, you might actually need multiple tests. And that's one of the reasons, actually, that I think is, that has been pushing, you know, CDC to actually tell us maybe we shouldn't test everyone whose people are asymptomatic, partly because it could take so many tests to assess whether, you know, they're negative. Are they still negative? Are they still negative?
It's just like a snapshot. You know, I can take a picture of the outfit I wore yesterday, but it has nothing to do with what I look like today. So it's just that quick snapshot of time. And of,
right, although the weird thing is the snapshot would tell you what you looked like yesterday.
Right.
It's not like it could accidentally miss. Or maybe it's a snapshot and it's only one perspective. So you might have had a black eye on one side and the snapshot caught your other side.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay, yep,
and
I
so
gotcha.
You hadn't been revealed in the fullness of your identity yet.
My full injury is not revealed. You mentioned a Bucknell professor. May I watch that video?
Yes, certainly. And I believe I can. I have not yet shared that on social media for Lewisburg neighborhoods, but I think following this, I can tie that in. Yep.
There's still a lot of people saying, well, okay, you know, we can do all this testing, but we know that a lot of people do get the virus, and it's kind of a low-grade thing for most people. I mean, there's only been 5 deaths in Union County attributed to COVID-19, so certainly most of them are older. In the words of one of our good listeners to the talk show, they could have died by now anyway. So, I'm sorry, just repeating. What's your thought, this idea that there's a lot of, not callous, but everybody has a different perspective and says that we should handle this in a certain way. We shouldn't necessarily, you know, lock ourselves down or, you know, do all these restrictive things and wear a mask everywhere we go.
Right. So one of the confusions, and this is sort of a natural thing, is the idea that if, you know, well, if I have come down with a minor case, in fact, what if I'm asymptomatic? People imagine that if they're asymptomatic, that they would only ever give anyone else a very mild case, that they, if they themselves exhibit fewer symptoms, that anyone they sickened would also, you know, they just pass on that mildness. And unfortunately, that isn't how it works. So the severity of the case has something to do, it has to do with a lot of different factors, but even a person with a mild case can be shedding enough virus to give other people they come in contact with a really bad case. And those other people might just get, you know, exactly the wrong amount in exactly the wrong way for their bodies, and their body, you know, tries to fight it off and just sort of becomes collateral damage to their own immune system. That's the key. So there is this idea that, well, we just have to live our lives, and people who are particularly vulnerable need to, they just need to figure this out and protect themselves extra well. And that, you know, protecting people who are really vulnerable actually looks like everyone else wearing masks. And so that's one hard thing, right? People imagine they're putting a mask on for themselves, and we keep saying this, that, you know, my mask protects you and your mask protects me, but a lot of people don't really get that. You know, they can only think of the mask as sort of a sign that they are fearful or that they feel vulnerable, when in fact it's a recognition of other people having vulnerabilities.
One of the things I've noticed, mostly on social media, not so much in the in other reporting, is that the CDC talks about the fact that 6% of the individuals who have died from COVID-19 had COVID-19. All the rest had something else. Put the truth behind that. Of course, that statement is certainly true, but it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Right. So a lot of people sort of jumped on that and leapt to the conclusion that then all the rest of the people with COVID-19, deaths attributed to COVID-19 were not actually caused by COVID-19. And part of this is just confusing wording. Sometimes, you know, people or organizations don't say things particularly clearly. Other times, part of it is also is just people misreading, maybe because they want to or it is confusing. And part of it is just people really looking for something that will allow them to make an argument that they have been trying to make all along. The catch here is that there is some, you know, not everyone is used to either reading death certificates or much less sort of the rules that go into filling them out. And the way death certificates work, there are multiple fields on a death certificate, and partly this is to collect good information, right? Long-term, retroactively, we can go back and gather data from death certificates about all sorts of things. I mean, we collect data about, you know, suicides, and we collect data about flu, and, you know, retroactively. That's one reason we actually don't get our official counts for flu for, like, a year or so, because it takes so long to go through all of the death certificates from previous years. So right now, we're still in the thick of going through current COVID-19 death certificates, and this was the CDC statement was a first, you know, a part releasing some of the information from that. So what happens on those death certificates? They actually go ahead and tell us, well, there, you know, that there are conditions that led directly to the cause of death, and then there are other conditions that were present and, you know, could have contributed, but that doesn't mean they were themselves the cause of death. Now, COVID could be in either of those places on the death certificate. For example, in our community, there's been some contention apparently about a toddler who died from drowning, and apparently they did have information that they tested positive for COVID, so COVID was listed on the death certificate, but it was not listed as the cause of death or a cause of death. It was listed as a condition at the time of death. So that means that death does not get counted as a COVID death. So that's one confusion which happened to crop up locally very recently, and it's confused, you know, illustrates part of the confusion. The other side of it is that you might have died with multiple conditions contributing. It doesn't mean that if you die, you had COVID and it caused, a severe respiratory distress and it caused a stroke. You know, it doesn't mean that because you had these other things that you didn't die of COVID. It also doesn't mean that because you were obese or had COPD or something like that, that COVID didn't kill you as well. So the fact that only 6% only had COVID listed means that that's reflective of fewer healthier people dying, but or more of a component of the total number of deaths being those being relatively healthy people. But it, you know, people read it a different way because they want it to mean that very few of the deaths we've counted are actually COVID deaths.
Well, they read it in a way that they want it to read. I love that. There's a lot of that going around. Okay, well, I'm going to put you back on hold. We'll be back at 7:40 with more. We have more to cover. I think a few more words about just the fact that the CDC guidelines don't always stay the same. You had mentioned that this idea of conversation about herd immunity seems to be growing strength rather than diminishing. And so we'll talk about those topics. Samantha Pearson's on the Newsline, Executive Director, Lewisburg Neighborhoods, Helm Street Manager, Walk It, Bike It Coordinator, and podcaster with Radio Free Lewisburg, helping us do not so much a myth busting, but making sure that we're talking about what is the best practices and some of the accepted truths related to some of the things that you may read on social media or elsewhere.
On the air at News Radio 1070 WKOK and online at WKOK.com. This is WKOK Sunrise.
Thank you for joining us on WKOK Sunrise. We're right in the middle of our interview with Samantha Pearson, Executive Director of Lewisburg Neighborhoods, Elm Street Manager and Walk It, Bike It Coordinator, and one of the producers of the Radio Free Lewisburg podcast. Samantha, when we last spoke, we started to talk about the fact that herd immunity is really being talked about lately, and maybe we should just take the elderly and isolate them so they don't get this disease. Your observations about those observations.
Sure. So herd immunity is a really attractive concept. And what's actually kind of funny about it is that in a normal year, public health people would be really trying to get people to take herd immunity seriously because they would want lots of people to get vaccinated for the flu, even people who don't think they're particularly at risk. And that's one of the key pieces here, is that people who themselves might not be particularly at risk from a specific infection, whether it's the flu or, in this case, coronavirus, they are still part of spreading or stopping the disease. And so we get into our heads that, oh, we could just get through this. And there are things we get to herd immunity with, and most of those things we don't notice. Some of them we use vaccines to get to. The ones that don't, that we just do allow to move through the community, we don't notice, partly because they have very low fatality rates. And so that, it just fizzles out eventually, and the long-term consequences just are, you know, people got colds and stuffy noses. That's not what we're talking about here. If we do let this run through, now people keep doing mathematical modeling and arguing that, oh, we don't need 70% of the population to be immune in order to reach herd immunity. It's more like 50 or 40%. There are some people even arguing for 20 or 10%. The thing is, though, that there is a catch with this. So people are pointing to, say, parts of Spain or New York City or parts of Italy. They may have reached herd immunity, but those are precisely places that have had really serious tolls. And so, and even in those places, it's not homogenous. So Spain as a whole, I think, has been estimated to have about 6% immunity at, or 6% infection and presumed immunity at this point. Some areas may be quite high. Similarly, some neighborhoods in New York have really had high rates of exposure, and other areas, even still in New York, have not. So it's, you know, herd immunity, it's not clear how effective that will be. Plus, who are we trying to protect? Is it just really old people? There's actually four different categories of most concern. People, some is old, and there's different cutoffs, whether that's, you know, over 60, over 70. One is, you know, people that have pre-existing health conditions. Another is people who are pregnant. And then in addition to pre-existing health conditions, there's the question of whether you have sort of underlying complications like a cancer diagnosis, or, you know, your just things that would complicate your care no matter what. Now, those four categories, that's all very fine and well, but the real kicker is it also includes anyone who lives in a household with anyone in one of those categories. And that really does bump us up, bump up the numbers of how many people we would be talking about if we, quote, just protect the most vulnerable. Like when we look at, there's been some studies recently looking at schools, and assessing existing health conditions for different categories, like teachers in schools and parents of school-age children. And they both come up with basically around 50% of teachers and around 50% of adults living with school-age children being in one of those vulnerable categories. And so, you know, that's a lot. That's not, oh, we'll just protect some people really seriously. Once you get up to 50%, you're talking about a lot of disruption in order to just protect the most vulnerable.
Tell me some more about contact tracing. You had mentioned that that's a topic that could use clarifying.
And right.
Go ahead.
Right. So this is one of those things that also reveals sort of the tentacles and the complications of trying to deal with this infection head on. In the same way that we start, involving more and more people, or seeing that we need to be very protective of more and more people by inspecting who actually is in a vulnerable category, contact tracing sees how many people a given reported case may have impacted in a community. So we might have what's called the index case, someone who has a confirmed case of coronavirus, might have one in a community. But then contact tracing is the process of first a public health department person talking to that index case and figuring out with them a long list of people who may have been exposed by that person. Then contact tracers take up that list, the list of potential contacts. Contact tracers, for confidentiality, don't ever actually know who the index case was. They just get a list of people who have been exposed to someone and start trying to communicate with them. That list starts getting complicated because anyone who has had a serious exposure to someone with a confirmed case would then be asked to quarantine themselves, meaning put themselves into isolation for 14 days and monitor themselves to make sure that they're not getting, they're not coming down with COVID. So, but that 14 days doesn't mean you're sick, but you could still be in quarantine. So if you had one student in a classroom, there could be multiple students, not necessarily the entire class, depending on conditions, but there could be multiple other students in that class, even though the one person is now out actually sick, there could be multiple other people who are out quarantining. Those kids, in some cases, or kids or other people in an office, they might have other close contacts themselves if they come down with something in the course of their 14 days. Their household members would likely be close contacts, and they in turn would have to quarantine. You can even get into a situation where you have one person quarantining in a household. They eventually, finish their quarantine, but, you can actually get people who have stacked quarantine periods so that you could be quarantining and then come down with the disease, in which case you then have to continue to confine yourself because you're actually sick. So on average, you're still, even for the least impact, it would probably be like a 17-day quarantine for that, because you would have incubated for a few days, like 5 to 7 days, come down with it, and then even if you have a really mild case but you've tested positive, another 10 days from the positive test before you could emerge from quarantine. And that's only if you actually don't have symptoms. So it's a combination of 10 days plus no fever for 2 to 3 days.
I'm going to ask you to elaborate a little bit on the Spotlight Orange effort and the campaign. I was at that news conference that was held not too long ago, and I noticed on the Buffalo Valley site that we went over the limit for 25 in one room at that event. So I think we violated that, the reporters and the firefighters from William Cameron and so on, and of course all the good community leaders. But talk about what Spotlight Orange is and what it entails, and we have a minute left.
Sure. Go ahead. So Spotlight Orange is a system of highlighting our positive responses here in our region to the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic. We are looking for people who are doing the right thing, rising to the challenge, and also we're asking people with our COVID-safe pledge to call themselves out for good behavior and help people know that they are really protecting their community. On the number of people who were there, we were in the bay of the firehouse, and we actually had the garage doors open, so it was a borderline. We were indoors, but it was a sort of marginal indoors. There was a lot of cross ventilation, so while we weren't trying certainly to, we have pictures, everyone was quite spread out, we were not doing an intense gathering. We could perhaps have asked some of the non-reporters to leave. That might have been a good thing to take into account. That actually reminds me, in general, in fact, one person wasn't there because they were not feeling well. That's something that parents who are going to be watching sports may want to keep in mind. That's the real ringer for being able to be a spectator. Wash hands, wear masks, and if you don't feel well, don't go.
And you can go to spotlightorange.org to get more information. Samantha, thank you so much. We'll hear from you again in the days and weeks ahead. We always appreciate your updates, and we invite folks to go to lewisburgneighborhoods.org, spotlightorange.org, and follow the podcast, Radio Free Lewisburg, at Lewisburg Neighborhoods, and stay up to date with the very latest information. Thank you so much, Samantha.
Good to talk to you, Mark.
Samantha Pearson, Executive Director of Lewisburg Neighborhoods, Elm Street Manager, Walk It, Bike It Coordinator, and one of the producers of the Radio Free Lewisburg podcast.